Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Mind's Eye Radio. My name is Trevor, and I will be reading articles of politics, opinion, finance, business, science, and art from The Economist, from the 34th week of 2023. Cover story: Lessons from the Blaze That Leveled Lahaina. Deadly wildfire on Maui steals Hawaiians' homes and history. When King Kamehameha I united the Hawaiian Islands in the early 1800s, he made Lahaina the capital of his new kingdom. The seaside city on western Maui was his crown jewel. Missionaries and whalers flocked to its shores. Kings and queens were buried in the graveyard of Waialua Church. Later, it became a tourist destination. Surf shops, bars, and museums lined its streets. 13,000 people called Lahaina home. Now, an ashen moonscape lies between the mountains and the sea where it once stood. The wildfire that swept through town on August 8th was indiscriminate. Scores of birds lie dead on the ground throughout the burn zone, felled by flames or the toxins they released. White picket fences melted. For many homes, the only thing left is the scorched husk of a washing machine sitting amid rubble where a laundry room once stood. Skeletons of cars sit where they were overtaken by the inferno. Some drivers abandoned their vehicles, climbed over the seawall, and threw themselves into the Pacific to escape the flames. As of August 16th, the fire had killed at least 111 people, making it the deadliest blaze America has seen in more than a century. The death toll is certain to climb. Rescue crews and dozens of cadaver dogs are still searching the burned area. More than 1,000 people are missing. Several factors contributed to Lahaina's demise. Drought worsened rapidly on Maui this summer. Rainfall has declined in Hawaii over the past 30 years as the climate has warmed. Invasive and flammable grasses have flourished on what used to be farmland. And high winds brought by Hurricane Dora provided the right conditions for a blaze to form and to spread. All that was needed was a spark. What ignited the fire is still uncertain, but testimony and videos from Lahaina residents suggest that a utility pole snapped in the wind, breaking a power line. Sparks quickly became flames. Two Lahaina residents have already filed a class action lawsuit against Hawaiian Electric, which serves 95% of Hawaiians, alleging that the utility was negligent in keeping its lines energized during dangerous weather conditions. Besides the cause of the fire, two questions are playing on the minds of Maui residents. First, is why the island's warning system did not alert locals to the danger. Outdoor sirens throughout the islands are meant to be used to warn Hawaiians of all manner of hazards, from tsunamis to wildfires to terrorist threats. But as flames consumed 2,200 buildings, which would cost $5.5 billion to rebuild, all 80 sirens in Maui County were silent. Demetrius Clark and Lilinoe Fonohema were already stuck in gridlock when they realized that the fire was headed in their direction. Rather than an alert or a siren call, their first sign of trouble was the smoke. All we could see is just black smoke covering our town and just getting worse by the moment, says Mr. Clark. Then they noticed the flames. Herman Andea, Maui's emergency management chief, has defended the decision not to use the sirens, arguing that locals might have sought safety on higher ground, as they would for a tsunami, and ended up in the middle of the fire. Yet the flames swallowed the town anyway. That the fire took Lahaina by surprise should serve as a warning, both for places accustomed to extreme weather and those that are not. A warming climate means disasters such as fires and floods will become more common and more severe, making it imperative that towns routinely update and test their emergency warning systems and evacuation plans. The second question is where to house people who have lost everything. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Kahului turned its basketball gym into an emergency shelter. Volunteers used tarps to create separate bedrooms, each with an air mattress and some blankets. America's Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, is putting fire victims up in hotel rooms, but these are short-term solutions. The need for housing in the midterm and long term is going to be one of the most challenging aspects of this recovery, says Keith Turi, a FEMA official. Making things worse is Hawaii's housing shortage. The state's median listing price is nearly twice the nation's. Last month, Josh Green, the state's Democratic governor, signed an emergency proclamation to hasten development, but thousands more Hawaiians will now be searching for a home. Some may not find one. Homelessness spiked in Chico, California, after the Camp Fire incinerated the nearby town of Paradise. The housing shortage also raises a tricky economic question for the island. In 2019, the Maui Economic Development Board reckoned that 51% of workers in the county were employed by the tourism industry. If visitors stay away because of the fires, or hotel rooms are filled with survivors instead of vacationers, the local economy will suffer. For now, Lahaina's residents are scattered across Maui, mourning the loss of their homes and their history. Many locals say they want to rebuild what they lost. Miss Fonohema chokes up as she recalls what the town streets were like before the blaze. Lahaina will always be home, she says, but it won't be the same. Section 1. American stocks are at their most expensive in decades. Are they worth the cost? Try a little, and it is never too hard to argue that the stock market looks risky and a crash must be coming. But in the long run, such arguments are usually best ignored. Since 1900, American shares have posted an average real return of 6.4% a year. Over three decades, that would transform the purchasing power of $1,000 into $6,400. Bonds, the main alternative, do not come close. With an average historical return of 1.7% a year, they would generate a measly $1,700. Cash would do worse still. The lesson for today's investors, many of whom were caught out by this year's bull market, might seem obvious. Forget about a downturn that may or may not materialize. Just buy and hold stocks and wait for returns that will erase any number of brief dips. Unfortunately, there is a catch. What matters today is not historical returns, but prospective ones. And on that measure, shares now look more expensive, and thus lower yielding, when compared with bonds than they have in decades. Start with why stocks tend to outperform bonds. A share is in a claim on a firm's earnings stretching into the future, which makes returns inherently uncertain. A bond, meanwhile, is a vow to pay a fixed stream of interest payments and then return the principal. The borrower might go bust. Changes to interest rates or inflation might alter the value of the cash flows. But the share is the riskier prospect, meaning it needs to offer a higher return. The gap between the two is the equity risk premium, the 4.7 percentage points a year that stocks have historically earned over bonds. What of the next few years? Estimating the return on a bond is easy. It is just its yield to maturity. Gauging stock returns is trickier, but a quick proxy is given by the earnings yield, or expected earnings for the coming year divided by share price. Combine the two for 10-year Treasury bonds and the S&P 500, and you have a crude measure of the equity risk premium that looks forward rather than back. Over the past year, it has plummeted. Now consider the equity risk premium's moving parts: earnings, Treasury yields, and share prices. Both expected earnings and Treasury yields are roughly where they were in October, when share prices hit a trough. But since then, shares have risen a lot, shrinking their earnings yield and bringing it closer to the safe Treasury yield. This might mean three things. Investors might believe earnings are about to start growing fast, perhaps because of an AI-fueled productivity boom. They might think earnings have become less likely to disappoint, justifying a lower risk premium. Or they might fear that treasuries, the benchmark against which stocks are measured, are now more risky. Sustained earnings growth is the dream scenario. The second option, though, is less rosy, that investors have let their revived animal spirits get ahead of them. Ed Cole of Man Group, an asset manager, argues the squeezed equity risk premium has a bet on a soft landing, in which central bankers quash inflation without a recession. This has become easier to envisage as price rises have cooled and most countries have so far avoided downturns. Yet surveys of manufacturers still point to recession in that sector, and the full dampening effect of rate rises may not yet have been felt. The third possibility is that, rather than cooing over stocks, investors are shunning the alternative. Last year was the worst for bonds in both America, where they lost 31% in real terms, and across developed markets, a 34% loss, in over a century. After that, says Sharon Bell of Goldman Sachs, a bank, it is unsurprising if some investors are wary of bonds and inclined to splurge on shares, especially if they believe inflation has moved structurally higher, something shares, as claims on nominal earnings, protect against, whereas bonds, deriving value from fixed coupons, do not. At the same time, governments are set to issue ever more debt to cover aging populations, defense spending, and cutting carbon emissions, while central banks have disappeared as buyers. Higher bond yields and a mechanically lower equity risk premium will be the result. This would imply a regime change to one where the equity risk premium has shifted lower for the long term, rather than temporarily to be corrected by a fall in share prices. Whatever the reason for the squeeze, investors have now placed their bets on rising profits. In a recent analysis, Duncan Lamont of Schroders, an investment firm, compared returns on the S&P 500 going back to 1871 with the yield gap against 10-year treasuries. He found the relationship has not been helpful in giving a steer on short-term market movements. Over the longer term, though, there is a clear link. For stocks starting with a low yield gap to do well over 10 years, a near condition has been real earnings growth. Animal spirits can only take you so far before earnings must deliver. They would not have to slip far for even a long-term investor to conclude today's market is too pricey. Section 2. Authoritarians are on the march. They argue that universal values are the new imperialism, imposed on people who want security and stability instead. Here is why they are wrong. The fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 held out the promise that growing prosperity would foster freedom and tolerance, which in turn would create more prosperity. Unfortunately, that hope disappointed. Our analysis this week, based on the definitive global survey of social attitudes, shows just how naive it turned out to be. Prosperity certainly rose. In the 3 decades to 2019, global output increased more than fourfold. Roughly 70% of the 2 billion people living in extreme poverty escaped it. But individual freedom and tolerance evolved differently. Many people around the world continue to swear fealty to traditional beliefs, sometimes intolerant ones. And although they are much wealthier these days, they often have an us-and-them contempt for others. The World Values Survey takes place every 5 years. The latest results, which go up to 2022, canvassed almost 130,000 people in 90 countries. Some places, such as Russia and Georgia, are not becoming more tolerant as they grow, but more tightly bound to traditional religious values instead. At the same time, young people in Islamic and Orthodox countries are barely more individualistic or secular than their elders. By contrast, the young in Northern Europe and America are racing ahead. Countries where burning the Quran is tolerated and those where it is a crime look on each other with growing incomprehension. On the face of it, all this supports the campaign by China's Communist Party to dismiss universal values as racist neo-imperialism. It argues that while Western elites are imposing their own version of freedom and democracy on people who want security and stability instead. In fact, the survey suggests something more subtle. Contrary to the Chinese argument, universal values are more valuable than ever. Start with the subtlety. China is right that people want security. The survey shows that a sense of threat drives people to seek refuge in family or racial or national groups, while tradition and organized religion offer solace. This is one way to see America's doomed attempts to establish democracy in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as the failure of the Arab Spring. Amid lawlessness and upheaval, some people sought safety in their tribe or their sect. Hoping that order would be restored, some welcomed the return of dictators. The subtlety the Chinese argument misses is the fact that cynical politicians sometimes set out to engineer insecurity because they know that frightened people yearn for strongman rule. That is what Bashar al-Assad did in Syria when he released murderous jihadists from his country's jails at the start of the Arab Spring. He bet that the threat of Sunni violence would cause Syrians from other sects to rally round him. Something similar happened in Russia. After economic collapse and jarring reforms in the 1990s, Russians thrived in the 2000s. Between 1999 and 2013, GDP per head increased 12-fold in dollar terms. Yet that did not dispel their accumulated dread. President Vladimir Putin consistently played on their ethno-nationalist insecurities, especially when growth later faltered. That has culminated in his disastrous invasion of Ukraine. Even in established democracies, polarizing politicians like Donald Trump and Jair Bolsonaro, former presidents of America and Brazil, saw that they could exploit left-behind voters' anxieties to mobilize support. So they set about warning that their political opponents wanted to destroy their supporters' way of life and threatened the very survival of their countries. That has, in turn, spread alarm and hostility on the other side. Even allowing for this, the Chinese claim that universal values are an imposition is upside down. From Chile to Japan, the World Values Survey provides examples where growing security really does seem to lead to tolerance and greater individual expression. Nothing suggests that Western countries are unique in that. The real question is how to help people feel more secure. China's answer is based on creating order for a loyal, differential majority that stays out of politics and avoids defying their rulers. However, within that model lurks deep insecurity. It is a majoritarian system in which lines move, sometimes arbitrarily or without warning, especially when power passes unpredictably from one party chief to another. A better answer comes from prosperity built on the rule of law. Wealthy countries have more resources to spend on dealing with disasters, such as pandemic disease. Likewise, confident in their savings and the social safety net, the citizens of rich countries know that they are less vulnerable to the chance events that wreck lives elsewhere. However, the deepest solution to insecurity lies in how countries cope with change, whether from global warming, artificial intelligence, or the growing tensions between China and America. The countries that manage change well will be better at making society feel confident in the future. And that is where universal values come into their own. Tolerance, free expression, and individual inquiry help harness change through consensus forged by reasoned debate and reform. There is no better way to bring about progress. Universal values are much more than a Western piety. They are a mechanism that fortifies societies against insecurity. What the World Values Survey shows is that they are also hard won. Section 3. What drives people to vote the way they do? A new study using data on charity donations highlights the role of moral values. Understanding how voters choose a candidate is a fundamental topic in political science. In an ideal democracy, voters would study policy manifestos and pick the slate that most closely matches their views. Reality, however, is messier. One long-standing explanation of voters' behavior is that they support candidates who represent or advocate for the interests of their social group, often defined on the basis of age, class, ethnicity, or gender. A more recent school of thought, called moral foundations theory, posits that a few broad philosophical values, such as the importance of fairness or authority, shape people's political preferences. Such principles are harder to measure than demographic data. In the past, proponents of this interpretation have had to rely on surveys, which may not accurately reflect respondents' true beliefs or voting records. But a recent paper by Benjamin Enke and Stephen Sun of Harvard, Raymond Fisman of Boston University, and Luis Mota Freitas of Oxford managed to assess variation in one such value, particularism versus universalism, from real-world data. They found that it predicts American voters' choices more accurately than many oft-cited demographic variables do. The particularism-universalism axis tracks how much people favor those close to them, such as family or neighbors, over those with whom their ties are weaker. This distinction maps neatly onto the philosophical differences between America's major political parties. Using speeches made by members of Congress, the authors found that Republican lawmakers typically used far more particularist language than Democratic ones did. To test if the same is true for voters, the authors devised a clever method to measure particularism in each of America's congressional districts using charitable donations. Donors Choose, a nonprofit, allows people to donate online to classroom funding requests from public school teachers. It provided data on 4 million donations, including the locations of donors and recipients. The authors argued that the more people in a district prioritized giving to nearby schools, the more particularist they were. They measured proximity both geographically and socially by analyzing the number of Facebook friendships linking pairs of districts. The latter measure reflects the strong ties people who move to cities have with their places of origin. People in every district gave more to nearby causes than to far-off ones. But the most particularist districts were also the most Republican. The 10 most particularist districts had Democratic vote share 45 percentage points lower than the 10 least. Differences in levels of particularism could predict some 25% of the variation in a district's vote share, more than the amount explained by some core demographic characteristics like income, 0.2%, and education, 2%. Moreover, its effect remained statistically significant even after accounting for the impact of other traits, such as a district's racial makeup. These findings do not refute other explanations of voter behavior. Predictions using both demography and particularism were more accurate than those based on either alone. But they do suggest that explanations of elections that exclude philosophical values are probably incomplete. Section 4. If it can be designed on a computer, it can be built by robots. Powerful new software rewrites the rule of mass production. In a factory on the Carolinas border, Stanley Black & Decker is assembling cordless electric drills. As part-finished drills travel in boxes along a conveyor belt, a robotic arm photographs and scans them for defects. Another robot nestles electric motors into the drill's casings. A third one places and tightens screws. A single piece of software oversees the entire production line, which is capable of pumping out 130 cordless power tools every hour under the supervision of just 7 humans. The assembly line it replaced in China needed up to 40 workers and rarely produced more than 100 an hour. 30 years from now, we will laugh at our generation of humans putting products together by hand, predicts Lior Susan, the boss of Bright Machines, a San Francisco-based company that installed the plant's software. It is not that the design of the electric drills or the various steps involved in making them have changed. Rather, it is the way the automated machines doing the work are being driven by instructions that have been encoded into software having been in effect copied from the brains of Chinese factory workers, who mostly did the job manually. Making things this way resembles a model used by the semiconductor industry, where chips are designed using software that directly links to the automated hardware which fabricates them. For the Fort Mill plant, and other firms starting to employ such software-defining manufacturing systems, it promises to transform the factory of the future by allowing more sophisticated products to be designed and put into production more quickly, all of which promises big cost savings. To understand why, consider a simplified version of how a new power tool is made. A team of designers come up with a fresh feature, say a longer-lasting battery. They map out every element of the new product, from the battery compartment to the circuitry, that needs to be changed as a result. It is complex work, not least because a small change to one component can have a big impact on another, and so on. The design is then thrown over the wall to the people responsible for making it. Sometimes that is a third-party factory, often in China. Engineers, designers, and production staff exchange information and meet up, constantly tweaking the design in response to the various successes or failures involved in making a series of prototypes. Little things, such as a screw that cannot be tightened correctly because it is hard to reach with an electric screwdriver, might result in a return to the drawing board, which nowadays is mostly a computer-aided design or CAD program. Eventually, all the kinks are ironed out, hopefully, and the new product is ready for production. The finer details of how all this was achieved, however, are likely to remain locked up in the minds of the workers assembling the prototypes. Humans are, after all, incredibly flexible and often come up with workarounds. This process has been employed for decades, yet is inherently uncertain and messy. Designers cannot predict with any confidence what things the factory can or cannot easily accommodate. As a consequence, the design team may purposely leave some features a bit vague and be put off innovative ideas for fear of being told it cannot be made or is impossibly costly. When the hardware is controlled by software rather than by humans, all this changes. Designers can dream up new products with a far greater certainty that they are manufacturable. This is because the constraints of the production line, even fiddly details like the positioning of screws, are encoded in their CAD programs. Those programs, in turn, are directly connected to the software which controls the machines in the factory. So, if a design works in a digital simulation, there's a good chance it will also run on the production line. This tight integration of manufacturing hardware and CAD software has been a boon in semiconductor manufacturing, where vast machines etch circuits onto silicon just a few nanometers, or billionths of a meter, wide. Chip designers with firms such as Apple, Nvidia, or Qualcomm use specialized programs, largely produced by two companies, Cadence and Synopsys, to sketch out the circuits. The design files are then sent directly to silicon foundries, such as TSMC in Taiwan, for production. Until the advent of these tools, people were laying out integrated circuits by hand, says Willie Shi of Harvard Business School. Mr. Shi imagines the impossibility of attempting to do that today with, for instance, Apple's M1 chip, which contains 114 billion transistors. Producing such complexity is only possible in a system where software allows humans to ignore the detail and focus on function. Stanley Black & Decker has not yet turned its CAD tools loose on Bright Machine's system to design new products, but the idea is that they soon will. What Cadence and Synopsys did to semiconductors is what we will do to product design, says Bright Machine's Mr. Susan. Some companies have already started designing products this way. Vulcanforms is a foundry, but one that makes metal components rather than chips. It operates out of a former aircraft hangar in northern Massachusetts, where its vast computer-controlled machines focus 100,000 watts of invisible laser light onto a bed of powdered metal. The powder melts and fuses into intricate patterns, layer by layer, until a component with dimensions specified to within a hundredth of a centimeter emerges. It could be part of the engine in a military drone or a perfectly formed hip replacement joint. This is the type of additive manufacturing, more popularly known as 3D printing. Vulcanforms' machines are driven by CAD software and can produce any metal component with a diameter up to about half a meter. When I became familiar with what Vulcanforms was doing, I could see predictable patterns that mirrored some of the learning with semiconductors, says Ray Stata, the founder of Analog Devices, an American chipmaker, and a member of the foundry's board. In chipmaking, he says, the software linking designer and manufacturer has produced huge gains in efficiency and economies of scale. Vulcanforms uses software made by N-Topology. This lets people without the skills required to operate lasers to design objects for production by the foundry. It can result in components with previously unmatched levels of performance because they can be produced as complex geometric structures which are impossible to manufacture any other way, says John Hart, Chief Technology Officer of Vulcanforms. Objects can be created at high volumes, such as forging 1,000 spinal implants from a single powder bed. With additive manufacturing, products can also be produced in one go, as single components, rather than being assembled from individual parts. This reduces the amount of material required, as the parts tend to be lighter. It also cuts down on assembly costs. Software-defined manufacturing has an impact on some of the big trade and political challenges faced by companies. For firms that are increasingly uncomfortable with relying on Chinese manufacturers, it can make reshoring production a more viable option. Mr. Susan puts it in Marshall terms. Manufacturing is a weapon. When we give design files to China, we give the source code of that weapon to our enemy. There will be implications for manufacturing jobs. Although automation usually means a reduction in the number of people assembling things on the shop floor, it also creates some jobs. Technicians are required to program and maintain production systems, and in offices, successful companies are likely to boost the numbers working in design, marketing, and sales. These jobs, though, require different skills, so retraining will be necessary. Mr. Shi also notes that factories themselves, not just the machine tools and processes within them, are coming under the thrall of software. He cites Technomatics, a subsidiary of Siemens, a German industrial giant, whose software lets designers lay out an entire factory so that the making of new products can be simulated in a virtual environment, known as a digital twin, before manufacture begins in its physical counterpart. If the future of manufacturing is following semiconductors, then there is still some way to go. Producing mechanical objects is not the same as etching elaborate circuits that have no moving parts. For a start, things are far less standardized, with components having all sorts of end uses. We are just at the beginning with mechanical structures, says Mr. Stata. The whole process of putting materials together in an additive method is in its very early stages. The flexibility and possibility that opens up is mind-boggling. Yet some of the implications are becoming apparent. Products could reach a level of performance and precision which is simply unachievable when their production is limited by human hands. Laying out a factory floor in two dimensions to accommodate human workers will become a thing of the past. Factories designed by software will be denser, much more complex three-dimensional places, full of clusters of highly productive, highly automated machinery. These factories of the future may be almost deserted places, attended to by a handful of technicians. But with software also taking care of the intricacies of production, they will be easier to use by people developing and designing new products. That should free their imaginations to soar to new levels. Section 5. American Workers versus Technological Progress. The battle heats up. The two flashpoints are artificial intelligence and electric vehicles. For more than 200 years, Luddites have received bad press, worse even than the British members of Parliament who voted in 1812 to put to death convicted machine breakers. Yet, even at the time, the aggrieved weavers won popular sympathy, including that of Lord Byron. In an Ode to Farmers of the Frame Bill, the poet wrote, "Some folks for certain have thought it was shocking, when famine appeals and when poverty groans, that life should be valued at less than a stocking, and breaking of frames lead to breaking of bones." He used his maiden speech in the House of Lords to urge for a mixture of conciliation and firmness in dealing with the mob, rather than lopping off its superfluous heads. Once again, technological upheaval is rife, and there is a widespread feeling, even among the patrician classes, that the old ways are in danger of being trampled underfoot by the march of progress. In America, two big labor disputes, one looming and the other well underway, are, among other things, grappling with potentially seismic transformations caused by decarbonization and artificial intelligence. The United Auto Workers, the UAW union, representing employees of Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, maker of Chrysler and Fiat, is threatening a strike when labor contracts end on September 14th. As well as fighting for sharply higher pay, one of its goals is to extend wages and other benefits offered in conventional car manufacturing to people working on electric vehicles, or EVs, the production of which typically uses more robots and fewer blue-collar workers. Over in Hollywood, writers and actors are at an impasse, with studios over pay and conditions in the streaming area, a dispute that has been muddied by the vexing question of how AI will reshape the industry if new tools can be used to write scripts or simulate actors. Such struggles may well shape how workers in other industries view the impact of technological change on their jobs. A new generation of union leaders has come out swinging. Sean Fain is the first president of the UAW in 70 years to emerge from outside the union's ruling clique. He was elected in March by the rank and file after a years-long corruption scandal led to a change in the union's voting procedures. From the start, Mr. Fain has cast himself as a firebrand. He publicly threw a bargaining proposal from Stellantis into the bin. The biggest shareholder in the firm, Exor, part owns the economist's parent company. Meanwhile, the Writers Guild of America and SAG-AFTRA, which represents actors, has gone on strike simultaneously for the first time in more than 60 years. Fran Drescher, leader of the Actors Guild and star of The Nanny, a 90s sitcom, has made clear that the showdown is part of a wider struggle. "The eyes of labor are upon us," she said in a thundering speech announcing the strike. The fights are taking place in an unusually supportive environment for unions. Late last month, more than half of the Senate's Democrats signed a letter to the Big Three car makers, arguing that workers at their battery plants should be eligible for the same deal offered to other UAW members. President Joe Biden, who equates good jobs with union jobs, has just reinstated a rule shelved during the Reagan administration that will, in effect, boost wages for construction workers on government-backed projects. Nationwide support for unions is at 71%, its highest level since the mid-1960s, according to Gallup, a pollster. Both in Detroit and in Hollywood, unions are tapping into popular disquiet over ballooning pay for CEOs. Even the Republicans, though vehemently anti-union, are trying to rebrand their relationship with workers. American Compass, a conservative think tank, calls for the creation of worker management committees, similar to Europe's work councils, which give employees a voice in how a business is run. Some academics contend that workers are right to be wary of technological change. Power and Progress, a newish book by Darren Acemoglu and Simon Johnson, both of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, wades through 1,000 years of history to argue that new technologies lead to better livelihoods only when they create jobs, rather than just cost savings, and when countervailing forces, such as unions, shape their effect. It berates techno-optimism and at times sounds like a Luddite's manifesto. Speaking to your columnist, Mr. Johnson expresses optimism that the UAW and the Big Three can find a way to ensure the switch to EVs does not lead to widespread job losses. He points to the eventual embrace by unions of the containerization of shipping, which saved countless hours of labor at ports, but also led to a surge in the amount of cargo that passed through them, preserving jobs and benefits for dockers. In theory, as EV production scales up, prices will come down and more drivers will buy them. If they put their feet on the gas, the Big Three may even be able to reverse the decline in America's car exports, fueling demand for even more workers. The massive subsidies handed out by the Biden administration to promote EV production afford the industry a rare opportunity to regain the initiative. By contrast, Mr. Johnson's prognosis for writers and actors in the age of AI is darker, likening their plight to that of the weavers-cum-Luddites whose jobs were rendered unnecessary by machines. That view helps explain why they are seeking to preemptively curtail studios' use of AI. Yet the technology impact on Tinseltown need not be zero-sum. By speeding up the writing process, for instance, AI could lower costs and allow more content to be created. What's more, the gales of creative destruction can be held back only for so long. For unions to secure their members' livelihoods, they need to work with technological change rather than against it. That means using a Byronesque combination of conciliation and firmness to ensure that it is used to grow the pie for everyone, rather than double down on anti-corporate rage. If not, they may end up, like the Luddites, on the wrong side of history. Section 6. Latin American cities are struggling in the livability ranking. Places in Asia have improved rapidly. Latin America is failing to keep up. Latin America is a place of extremes. In its geography, which ranges from idyllic beaches to rainforests to mountain peaks, its weather, the region is prone to natural disasters, and its politics, which swing from far right to far left. But when it comes to ease of living, its cities are middling, according to the latest livability index by EIU, our sister company. The ranking assesses 173 cities across the world in five categories: stability, healthcare, culture and environment, education, and infrastructure. On average, Latin American cities score 67 out of 100, below Asia and Eastern Europe, but above the Middle East and Africa. Life in Latin American cities has improved over the past year, thanks to better health care and education. That reflects the region's rebound after the pandemic disrupted schools and put pressure on hospitals. Lima in Peru, Montevideo in Uruguay, and Santiago in Chile all gained nearly 6 index points compared with last year. But the region's record is less stellar when compared with pre-pandemic times. Since 2019, every Latin American city in the index has slipped in the global ranking. Buenos Aires, which remains the region's most livable city, fell from 62nd place in 2019 to 73rd in 2023. Caracas in Venezuela, already the least livable city in Latin America, fell further, from 131st to an unenviable 163rd out of 173. Although Latin American cities are improving, they are not doing so fast enough. Cities in Asia, including Busan in South Korea and Shenzhen in China, are leaving many of them behind. Countries across Latin America still struggle with stubborn inequality and poverty. Although unplanned settlements, such as Rio de Janeiro's favelas, are becoming better places to live owing to falling crime rates, they still have poor access to clean water and sanitation. Climate change and the arrival of El Niño, the warming pattern of the El Niño Southern Oscillation, could make life harder too. Even as extreme weather looks likely to increase in frequency and severity, Latin American countries are failing to learn from past mistakes. Peru, for example, launched a $7 billion program to rebuild and strengthen its dams and defenses in the wake of massive flooding caused by the previous El Niño in 2017. Little of that money, however, actually went into flood prevention, and many of the same areas flooded this spring. To climb back up the ranking, Latin American countries will need to do better at limiting the impact of such extreme weather and eradicating poverty. There are reasons to be hopeful, however. In Brazil, cautious optimism about the economy has returned under Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who began a third term as president in January. And Latin America could benefit from the voracious appetite for metals and minerals needed for the green energy transition if the region's leaders do not squander the opportunity that could turn it into a commodity superpower. The world's gain could also be Latin America's. Section 7. Why sex differences matter in football. Women are not simply men with long hair, even on the pitch. For half a century, between 1921 and 1971, the Football Association, which governs the sport in England, forbade women from playing on FA-affiliated pitches. The game, it opined, is quite unsuitable for females. Tell that to the fans. The Women's World Cup, held this year in Australia and New Zealand, is gearing up for a final on August 20th between Spain and England, the reigning European champions. So far, more than 1.8 million tickets have been sold, breaking the previous record of 1.3 million in Canada in 2015. The television audience is likely to be double the previous record of 1 billion. The level of play is higher across the board. The struggle for women's football to be taken seriously has, so far, meant fighting for equality with the men's game. In terms of money and exposure, it still has a long way to go. Although women's prize money has more than tripled since the previous World Cup, it is still only 25% of men's hauls. The disparity in club wages is cavernous. One reason is that women's sport in general accounted for just 13% of TV sports coverage in Britain in 2022 and 5% in America in 2019. But on the field itself, football is scrupulously equal. Women play on the same size pitch, with the same size ball, and the same rules as men. And yet in sport, that sort of equality is not always a good idea. Feminists have long argued, correctly, that women are not just men with long hair. The unthinking assumption that men are the default human means that everything from drugs and smartphones to stab vests and airbags has been designed in ways that are inconvenient or dangerous for their female users. Similar arguments apply to many sports, an irony given that they are the reason why women's sport even exists as a separate category. Women's bodies are smaller, on average, than men's, even among elite athletes. One paper calculates that a pitch scaled for them would be two-thirds as big as it is now. Goals would be slightly smaller and the ball would be smaller and lighter. Expecting women to play on the same size pitch as men, the researchers point out, means asking them to play a game that is different from the one the men play, and harder. Another worry is the risk of injury. Until recently, making a woman's football boot meant little more than taking a men's one and coloring it pink. Never mind the different shape and structure of women's feet. Never mind that studs designed for a man's weight might provide too much grip for a lighter woman. And never mind how that might increase the risk of knee injuries, to which women seem more prone. But it is not just knees. A 2018 study found that repeatedly heading a football seemed to harm women's brains more than men's. Having seen brain damage among American football and rugby players, the sports authorities have a duty to consider using a lighter ball. Admittedly, such changes would be controversial. When World Rugby, the international governing body for rugby union, decided to test a smaller ball designed for women's smaller hands, players were split. Some welcomed the removal of what they saw as a handicap. Others worried that anything which looked like a concession risked undermining the prestige of the women's game. That is a real risk, but it can be overstated. Plenty of other sports accommodate the physical differences between the sexes. In athletics, women's hurdles are lower and discuses are lighter. Basketball uses a smaller ball. Volleyball, a lower net. Men and women should be treated equally in sport as in any other walk of life, but they are not physically the same, and it does no one any favors to pretend that they are. Section 8. The Rise of Kidulting. Experiences that let adults act like children are booming. A young woman slides herself gleefully into a fake bathtub filled with giant plastic bubbles. Snack bags of popcorn are handed out inside a room designed to look and sound like the inside of a popcorn machine. Friends snap selfies amid color-changing lights before heading to the pillow fight section and pummeling each other with feather-filled cushions. Dopamine Land, a pop-up interactive museum with locations in Madrid and London, is colorful, creative, and silly. Although it is family-friendly, most of the adults milling around on a recent Saturday at lunchtime have no offspring in tow. As the museum's marketing makes clear, this is a place for the inner child. Dopamine Land is just one example of a new cultural trend called kidulting, where adults engage in lighthearted activities traditionally designed for children. In Amsterdam, Wonder invites patrons to dive into a sea of pink marshmallows and write on the walls. The Museum of Ice Cream, a multi-story playground of pools filled with fake sundae toppings, has expanded from New York to several other American cities in Singapore. Bubble Planet, which started in Madrid, will soon have 13 locations in its orbit, including Brussels and Toronto. Bally Ballerson, which operates a giant ball pit for adults in three British cities, welcomes 25,000 visitors each month. Even museums and immersive exhibitions typically aimed at actual children now host adult-only evenings. This includes Kidzania, a model city in London that was, ironically, designed for children to play at grown-up activities such as having a job. Enthusiasts say that such spaces heighten creativity, human connection, and happiness, triggering the pleasure-seeking chemical that Dopamine Land is named after. But kidulting spaces are not for everyone. Their tendency to claim the title of museum can feel spurious to people who think such institutions should impart knowledge. Art exhibitions aim to leave participants seeing the world a bit differently, but venues like Dopamine Land try for little more than making visitors feel happy and sometimes tipsy. That most attendees have smartphones glued to their hands reinforces the critique that these spaces are little more than selfie backdrops for people obsessed with their own image. But perhaps the shallowness of these places is entirely the point. Negative emotions, including stress, sadness, and anger, have reached record highs, according to Gallup, a research firm that started tracking this globally in 2005. When the world feels bleak, the appeal of distraction is stronger. Meanwhile, millennials and Generation Z have found that growing up is not so easy to do. The milestones their parents achieved so effortlessly, such as buying a home and getting married, have become expensive affairs, out of reach for many. This all explains the lure of kidulting. Dopamine land, with its fancy dress boxes and picture-perfect backgrounds, asks nothing of its visitors. There is no information to take in, no rules to follow, no goals to achieve. It is amusing and vapid and brainless. That is what makes it so fun. Well, that's all the time I have for today, but thank you again for tuning in to Mind's Eye Radio. You've been listening to this week's edition of The Economist. This is Trevor, wishing you a good rest of your day.